Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. Woo, we've got a conversation today. It's going to be, we got two big topics we're going to be covering, and maybe two and a half. I don't know. It depends on how you cut it. We're going to be talking about the new research from the Common Ground Initiative that has some very interesting things to say about how Albertans believe other Albertans believe and what the reality actually looks like. And it turns out there's actually a pretty big space between those things. We're also going to be talking about the impacts of Bill 18 on the municipal level for sure, maybe a little bit on the academic level. And to have this conversation today, I am so excited to welcome back to the program. We've been trying to get him back for a little while now, but he's a very, very busy, very popular man. He's the lead at the Common Ground Initiative. He's a political scientist at the University of Alberta. Dr. Jared Wesley, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Always good to be back.
So, I mean, I give kind of a loose introduction, but it's been so very long since we've had you on. I'm wondering if you could give sort of the brief bio of Dr. Wesley for anyone who is new to the show and wasn't listening a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, first and foremost, I'm a very lucky husband and a father of two daughters here in Edmonton, in Treaty 6 territory. And I came to Alberta a number of years ago to do my first degree here at the U of A, and seemed to have found our way back to Edmonton. I'm loving working at the U of A. That was after about 5 or 6 years spent with the provincial government, working in intergovernmental relations and some cabinet coordination stuff. And throughout that whole time, you know, my life seems to center around this notion of trying to find common ground between people. You know, as a biracial kid, I grew up in a small town in Manitoba. I've often found myself, you know, caught between two different worlds, black and white, and throughout my life, moved back between rural and urban places. And for people like me, it's really tough to pick a side because we're on both sides. We got family, we got close friends on both sides. So that's what really what our research is driving towards, trying to find some common ground between, in this case, progressives and conservatives in Western Canada. And yeah, so we're having some fun. We're doing a lot of interesting focus group activities. We got Viewpoint Alberta survey that's been doing two a year since 2019, and my colleague Theo Snagovsky and I are happy to talk to anyone who wants to listen about some of the fascinating research that we've found.
Yeah, I remember the first time we had you on, you talked about and it was like it felt like a punch in the chest for me, because you were talking about the perception of what an Albertan looks like, and it is exclusive to so many different groups. So you've been doing this research for quite some time, and it's highlighted some really, really important things. What's the new batch about? If you can give us sort of the broad idea behind it, and then we'll drill down into some of the things.
Yeah, so I mean, we got kind of two streams of research. The first one that was on your show before, you're talking about how we have a very simple activity in our focus groups. We've been asking people to simply draw us an Albertan, right? Your listeners and viewers can go through that exercise right now in their own minds. When I say Albertan, something pops into your mind. What is it? And 80% of our adult participants will draw somebody who's either a cowboy, a farmer, or a rig worker, right? Middle-aged, white, blue-collar man. And we're trying to figure out, like, why is it that ubiquitous, right? Why is it that prevalent? Doesn't matter where we go. We did focus groups with a room full of young black women here in Edmonton, only two of whom out of 40, right? Only two drew a woman, and only two drew a person of color, right? We've done it with a group full of recent immigrants. I mean, when I say recent, I mean just arrived in Canada 2 weeks before the focus group down in Lethbridge. They all drew the same kind of thing. We called a persona Joe because Joe is the most common name that people associate with. So part of our research is trying to figure out, why is it that when people think of Alberta and Albertans, they think of Joe, right? The other part of our research, though, is trying to figure out, like, why do Albertans feel so polarized right now, right? We do a lot of survey research that shows that on some issues, Albertans are quite polarized, but at the same time, they also talk about how they feel moderate, right? When we ask people to check a series of boxes about political identities, it's actually moderate is the number one answer, right? Followed closely behind by conservative and progressive. But what's even more interesting is that people check all three of those boxes more often than not. You know, over 80% of Albertans check both progressive and conservative when they're asked to identify. So there's a sense that we're polarized, but are we really polarized? And over the last number of months, we've started to bring those two streams together and figure out, is there a relationship between us thinking about Albertans as Joe and polarization? And there actually is. And it boils down to this. There's a small group of people who want to make Alberta in Joe's image. And they'll do anything they can to preserve that part of Alberta's heritage. They're in control of government right now. If you need any proof of it, just look at the fact that it wasn't until a few months ago that we had rodeo named Alberta's provincial sport, right? Despite the fact that most people have never been to a rodeo, Stampede doesn't count. The spare grounds at least don't count. But there's been a really intentional effort on the part of the UCP government since Kenney to really instill this vision of Alberta being all about Joe, right? And there's another small group of people on the other side of the spectrum that are all about erasing Joe from our collective memories and erasing Joe from the spotlight that currently exists, right? These are the folks on the right will accuse of engaging in cancel culture, right? But our research shows that the vast majority of Albertans are caught in the middle, right? That most people are not out to erase Joe. They see the value that Joe brings to their communities historically, currently, and in the future. But they also see value in their own contributions, right? They want to be recognized for their contributions to the future of Alberta society. We're talking about the nurses, right? The doctors, right? Talking about the pharmacy workers. We're talking about, the folks that work in hospitality. So our research now in this summer, we're going to be going on the road again and talking to people about how we can forge that common ground so that everybody feels included and like they belong now.
I'm curious, what were the so when you were looking at the perspectives of how Albertans perceive their neighbors to believe the things versus what their neighbors actually believe. I'm not saying that very gracefully, but I think the point gets across. What were some of the topics that you looked at, and what did you find?
Yeah, we asked a series of questions around, I think, 14 different policy issues, right? We asked people two sets of questions. The first question is, how much do you support this particular issue? So, for example, I'll give you the easy one. To what extent do you support establishing a provincial sales tax in Alberta? It's not going to come as a surprise to anyone, and this is the point, by the way. It's not going to come as a surprise to anybody that only about one in five Albertans at least somewhat support that idea. But the follow-up question is an interesting one. What percentage of Albertans do you think is supportive of that? And 18, the average response to that question was 18. Now that's not a huge gap, right? 20% in favor of PST, but Albertans know that Albertans aren't in favor of it, right? We asked that question, but also asked a series of questions that were front and center in the government's agenda right now that are clearly unpopular, according to most public opinion polls, and frankly, that weren't in the UCP platform in the last election, right? We're talking about pension plan, we're talking about a police force. We also asked questions about pronoun disclosure, right? And what we found was on the first two, on pension plan and police force, Albertans are not in favor of that. Only 20%, the same percentage that supports a provincial sales tax, is in favor of abandoning the CPP or RCMP. But they also know that, right? So they actually know that's an unpopular position, right? Now that's a little bit different from pronoun disclosure. So we ask people, are you in favor of requiring schools to notify parents if kids want to use pronouns, different pronouns in school? And 57% of Albertans are supportive of that measure. And we ask the follow-up question, what proportion of Albertans do you think is supportive? It jumps to 69%. Now, that's not a game changer, right? I mean, it's clear that there's a majority opinion in favor of that policy the UCP introduced. That's a massive move, a massive shift over a short period of time. It jumped about 13 points over the last 6 months, according to our viewpoint surveys. But the 69% figure, that's what the proportion that people think is a supportive of it, shows that Albertans think there's a greater conservative consensus on that issue than actually exists. Right. The other issues, you want me to pause there? You want to keep going? I mean, the other issues that we looked
No, keep
at
going, please.
Yeah. I mean, the other issues we looked at were ones that weren't on the government's agenda, right? Things like maintaining the safe consumption sites in communities, right? And close to half of Albertans are in favor of that, and a much smaller proportion are against that idea of maintaining the number of them that we have in our communities. But when we ask the follow-up question, what proportion do you think is in favor of it? The number drops to the high 20s. There's a huge gap, 17 to 20 point gap between that. Same thing on whether the provincial government should send public funds to private schools. Majority of Albertans are supportive of eliminating public funding to private schools. Yet that number, when you ask what proportion do you think is in favor of that, it jumps again all the way back down to high 20s. A huge gap on those two issues. Probably the one for most listeners are attuned to is this notion of transitioning Alberta away from an oil and gas economy. It was that straight up. That was the question. 44% of Albertans consistently, since we've been polling on this back to 2022, have said 44% have said we're in favor of moving away from an oil and gas economy. The number that were opposed to that is only 24. There's a bunch of people in the middle, but 44% are in favor of the transition. But when asked what proportion do you think is in favor, number drops down to 27. So that gap between, the actual position, which is a moderate, some might say a progressive position on those three issues, and where Albertans think the mainstream consensus is huge. And governments that don't want to follow public opinion can exploit that gap, right? Because people might favor a more progressive or moderate approach to those issues, but they don't think anybody else is in support. And as a result, they're not going to stick their neck out and say something. And they might not come out in support of a politician or a party that favors those issues. If you're a leader of a political party or you are a politician, you might doubt yourself, right? Should I stick my neck out on these particular issues? And that's what one scholar in back in the early 1970s called the spiral of silence, right? That there's a lot of people that don't recognize they're in the mainstream on issues, and they'll remain silent because they are convinced that in this case, the typical Albertan, who again, our focus group participants named Joe, people aren't convinced that Joe is willing to move on these issues, then they're not going to stick their neck out for.
Wow, there's so much to unpack there. I have so many questions. I guess the first question that I want to start with, which you've kind of already addressed, is how much do these differences, obviously they translate to some degree to whether or not somebody's willing to say something publicly on social media or any of those things. But do you have any evidence, or is there any previous evidence into how this translates into things like voting trends? So, for example, Danielle Smith has said, you know what, if we do an APP, we'll put it to referendum. And this seems like one of the spaces where the overwhelming majority of people are like, nah, we don't want that. But there's a perception, a little bit of a difference, that maybe there's some people who do. Does that influence how people would potentially vote in that referendum or on any of this? I mean, looking at some of these bigger gaps, the oil and gas one, for example, would that influence how people vote?
Yeah, so two points on that. First, I mean, anybody that wants to hold a referendum on an issue in which Albertans are actually opposed, as I say, only about 20% of Albertans are in support of this, of a pension plan, for example. They not only have to change those people's minds, but they also have to change the public perception that this is a bad idea, right? And really, they're fighting against public opinion, but they're also fighting against political culture. The idea of the Canada Pension Plan is embedded in the Alberta political culture, right? I think it's maybe not necessarily embedded in the Alberta political culture, but Albertans are part of the Canadian political culture, where CPP, universal health care, and a bunch of other national institutions and programs are very important to them, right? And our polling shows that people are just worried about retirement security, right? They might buy a few of them, not many. About a third of Albertans are open to the argument that we'll pay less and get more from an Alberta pension plan. But even if they buy that, they're not willing to risk it because they're worried about that in the end. So the government has to work on two fronts: first, to change public opinion, and then to convince everyone that public opinion has changed. And those are two very difficult things. If you don't believe me, ask any progressive that's tried to push these marbles up the hill for generations here. But the second piece came out. We did a piece, and people can go to our Common Ground Substack to find it. We did a postmortem of the last election, and because people were often asking us, like, what, how do you attribute the New Democrats' loss in the last election? Unlike a lot of pollsters, we take our time with it, right? I mean, we're academics. We took a few months to do the postmortem, and the stat that popped out for me the most, I don't have the exact numbers on hand here, but I'll give you a ballpark. We asked people not only who are you going to vote for in this election, and it was pretty close. Our numbers were had the NDP numbers inflated a bit, but we were there just before the election, so some things might have moved. But let's say it's about 40% were in favor of voting for a new Democrat in their riding. Then we asked the question, which outcome would you like? Right, and again, high 40% range said I would like an NDP majority. Right, about the same as what wanted a UCP majority. But again, the third question was the most fascinating. Who do you think's going to win? And that number dropped to 25%.
Oh.
So even the most committed, and this tracked across all levels of commitment to the New Democrats, they honestly didn't believe the party could win. And so when I talk to people from all parts of the spectrum, any party politician or leader or staffer wants to come talk to me, I'll grab coffee with them. You Democrats came and asked, like, what was our biggest problem? I said, you didn't convince people you could win. And to me, that's fascinating, as it's playing out now in the NDP leadership race, is they have to create this aura that they are the government in waiting, right? And that they can win. That's the dual challenge that they have in front of them, right? Is they have to convince people to change their minds about the party, but then also change their minds about what's possible.
What are Smith's challenges? What's the UCP's challenges?
Well, I don't think they're facing many challenges right now. I mean, it's tough to get inside. Nobody that I know is behind closed doors when they're coming up with policy, right? Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later, about policy making in the UCP. But to me, it seems like they're driven right now about surviving the leadership review in the fall. So there's a lot of red meat being thrown around for barbecue season. And we'll see whether that settles. But after the leadership review, that they'll have to grapple with what looks like a Poilievre government in Ottawa as well, which, as I written in a recent Taiyi article, is going to be more problematic than I think a lot of people assume. I mean, you look at the last string of Alberta premiers, conservative premiers who have been in power that have had trouble. They've all been in power when there's been a conservative in power in Ottawa, right? I'm talking about Stelmach, Redford, Prentice. Before that, Don Getty was in power during the Mulroney years. And that's tough for them because they can't blame the scapegoat in Ottawa, right? So while the UCP has kind of made a brand for itself externally as standing up for Alberta, right, and presenting themselves and their premiers as guardians on behalf of Alberta, that technique has also helped, that tactic has also helped to keep together their coalition of supporters, social conservatives and libertarians and fiscal conservatives. Don't agree on much policy-wise, but they can all agree we all hate Justin Trudeau. Well, what happens when Justin Trudeau leaves? And that is a real challenge I think the UCP hasn't had to grapple with as a party, because they've always had this mantra of we're against Ottawa, we're against the Trudeau government. Well, what happens when the Trudeau government's not there anymore?
I mean, it is a wild thought exercise to think that a Poilievre government could have the potential impacts that it has on Canada, but it could be good for Alberta.
Well, I guess it depends on who you're rooting for.
Very
But
fair
I
point.
think, yeah, I think in terms of the most radical parts of the Fair Deal agenda, including, removing Alberta from the Alberta Pension Plan, which clearly most Albertans are against, yeah, it is good news because Pierre Poilievre has already telegraphed he's not prepared to support that. So I think both sides, and it seems like they've only appeared on stage to my count twice, and one was just very recently in a Calgary at a Calgary Axe to Tax event, right? It seems like the two sides have come to a realization they need to work together if they're going to govern together. And I've laid out some plans for them to gracefully climb down from the more radical positions here in Alberta to embrace what could be a new era of open federalism, right? I mean, especially if Polyev lays down his demands on cities. He's going to put a bunch of strings on federal funding to cities to build affordable housing and so on. If he climbs down from that, we could have a new era of open federalism, which, if Albertans will remember, was very good for them, right? But, ask Premier Stelmach, ask Premier Redford how it goes when you can't deflect attention away from domestic politics, right? You actually have to focus on the issues that are here at home.
Well, so much of the UCP's talking points when you see them at press conferences or at events is centered around, oh, the Justin Trudeau NDP alliance. They're the worst. They're the cause of all of our problems, and everything is bad because of them. And it would be fascinating to see how that messaging has to evolve with a conservative government, because who is going to be Danielle Smith's nemesis at that point? That's a and the UCP. I mean, Danielle Smith aside, even if the UCP go, oh, we don't like her anymore, there's still who's your enemy? And it
Right.
would be NDP, an enemy.
Right. But this is fascinating to me too, because the old adage, campaign adage that during the Ralph Klein days was, don't mention the opposition by name. And
Yes.
it's actually tough to go back and look at any reference whatsoever that Ralph Klein would make to opposition parties, even on the campaign trail. Why? Because he didn't have to, right? He had, in political science term, he had externalized the opposition.
There we go.
Right. And he made it all about standing up for Alberta against a marauding federal government, made opposition here unimportant. But tough to make that case in the two-party system now, where the New Democrats actually have a ground game and an establishment, and honestly, the largest opposition in provincial history. They're gonna have to deal with them.
I want to go back to the gaps that exist in some of those issues that you ask people about, because I mean, for some things, the Alberta pension plan, for example, it doesn't shock me that there's not a huge gap between, well, here's how I feel about the Alberta pension plan, and here's how I think everybody else feels about the Alberta pension plan, because there has been so much media coverage on it. But then when we look at some of the other issues, there's hasn't been quite as much, I'll say, mainstream media coverage. I'm curious. I mean, I'll just be blunt. My immediate reaction to the pronoun piece is, well, you've got True North and you've got Western Standard and you've got all of these right-wing media groups that have been beating that drum for the better part of 2 years now, to the point of, I mean, the Western Standard has been accused of straight up fabricating stories to increase that fever pitch of, oh my gosh, is that what drives the gap, the rage? I mean, I can't think of another term other than rage farming.
Yeah, I mean the outlets that you're talking about, of course, do that. But I think the story here so far on this issue is that the government got out in front of an issue before I think a lot of other trans rights advocacy groups got out in front of it. And they framed it. They successfully. I'm looking at the data. I don't have direct data on this, but I suggest. The 57% of Albertans that support this don't aren't not all of them. Some of them might be anti-trans, but I think a lot of them are just pro-parent, right? And so the framing of this issue as a parents' rights issue was massively successful for the government, and they have a megaphone. She went on that, if I remember right, she went on provincial TV to announce this particular measure, did she
Did
not?
she
Like
had
it,
an 8 minute
right?
little video?
I mean, it's textbook communication and framing, right? They framed the issue. They probably had the advantage of other governments in Saskatchewan and New Brunswick getting out ahead of it. But the big question to me is, are they out over their skis on this? Because it's not just that they went on the pronoun issue, but they also went hard on medical treatments for trans youth and getting between trans kids and their parents and their doctors, right? And I don't have data on that. We will go back into the field because we didn't anticipate that was going to be as far as they would go. So I would say that piece. But I think it's also important to recognize this is a pattern of policymaking for this government too. So Theo Snagowski is a colleague of mine at the University of Alberta, and I were talking about this, like, how do we make sense? Not attribute motives. Not even attribute strategy to this, because we're not in the back rooms where these kinds of decisions are being made, but to that point, hardly anybody is. It's a very tight, small circle that are making decisions on what to announce in terms of policy. And Thiel thought, as based on his research, that this is a matter of cheap talk. And I don't mean that disparagingly. In the piece that we have coming out soon, it's not about, being underhanded or dirty politics, but cheap talk is talk that you release a policy pronouncement with very low cost to yourself, because you're saying, well, we're thinking about this, right? And you don't have to invest any kind of advanced preparation for this. You don't have to do, as we say, the policy homework. You don't have to engage public servants. You don't have to do the consultations with the communities most affected. You announce it, you anchor the particular discussion at that point, and then you say, well, now we'll talk to everybody else about it. So, I mean, charitably, this is another example of them setting the agenda, right? And framing an issue in the way that they want it to be framed, and not allowing potential opponents, whether they be public servants who have been surprised, every bit as surprised a bunch of these announcements as we have, or members of the stakeholder groups and communities that are most affected by it, to change their minds about it, right? So we've seen that with the Sovereignty Act. We've seen that with the trans rights legislation. We've seen it with Bill 18, which I'm sure we'll talk about too, where they get out in front of it and then see where the public reaction is. Perhaps one hopes they go out and do the actual policy homework and engagement to get the policy calibration right with the regulations, if not changing the legislation itself. But that has real implications for Alberta democracy. Because on all of these issues we talked about, they also didn't telegraph it in an election platform at all. In fact, on some of them, they said we're not going to move on it, right? Like on pensions. And all of them, with the exception of pronouns, are massively unpopular. So how, yeah, so go ahead. Anything.
I got a bunch more questions just based on that. I mean, I almost wonder, one of the things that we have seen historically from Premier Smith is, I mean, you can call it cheap talk. I refer to it as spitballing, where she will, there's somebody asks a question, and the question may or may not be rooted in reality. It depends on the day and what media outlet she's appearing on. And then she kind of goes, well, here's what I think. And then we see her form these ideas real time. My favorite example is the let's deputize planes of vacationers to Florida as diplomats. You can't do that. But that was one of my favorite examples of her just sort of going like, well, let's take my limited understanding of the thing, and then I'm going to come up with a solution within that framework, and then we'll go with that. And I'm conflicted hearing you speak, because there's a part of me that goes, Smith makes up so much of what she does on the fly, and she's so willing to just jump into the issue. I'm curious, do you think that is that a deliberate framing thing? Or is her willingness to just speak on literally anything, giving her the benefit of this pre-framing?
Well, I mean, again, I don't know whether she's motivated by this, whether it's deliberate strategy or whether it's just part of her leadership style, right? But we didn't see much of this when she was in opposition. That's the thing. Cheap talk is actually quite common on the opposition side, because there's really no cost to coming up with ideas on the fly. You don't actually have to implement any of them. So we didn't see much of this, right? I mean,
Yeah.
in seriousness, we didn't see much of this. I don't recall, at least when she was Wild Rose leader, maybe just because she didn't have the access to the mic that she does now on the podium, right? But more worrisome, I don't want to be facetious here, but it seems to be getting contagious, right? I mean, a couple of weeks ago, an entire news cycle was chewed up by this notion of having 4 liter jugs of vodka in South Edmonton. Your listeners probably know this too, but I
They
mean,
do.
so a reporter snapped a photo of a four liter jug of vodka, and just asked a simple question like, "What the hell is this?" Right? And within, I think, 36 hours, we had a minister stepping out in front of the camera saying, "This is wrong, and I'm going to do something about it." What are you going to do about it? First of all, that doesn't fit with the libertarian side of the UCP, where the market should be driving some of this stuff, right? People should be responsible for their own children. There was all talks about how kids were going to be affected by this, well, whereas parents' rights fits into this. But more than that, I mean, I'm not going to tell tales out of school, but I still have a lot of friends in the Alberta Public Service in various corners. And what's more worrying to me is that they're making up this policy on the fly without any kind of expert input. And maybe that's part of the populist approach, that we don't need to listen to experts on this stuff. But a lot of public servants are not radicals by any means, but they can tell you, we've looked at this before and it was a dead end, right? You shouldn't go down that path. On policing, on pensions. When I was in government 10 years ago, we were studying those issues. We were briefing up all the time to ministers who were asking questions. And ultimately, they were dissuaded based on the public opinion research we had or the public policy research we had. That doesn't seem to be going on in Alberta today. And I guess that's from a classic public policy standpoint, really quite worrisome, right?
Well, this is where I was, one of the other directions I was hoping to take the conversation is it seems like a lot of the policies are being built rhetoric first, and then we'll determine what the actual evidence and legal framework and all of the other things are. And then we'll go, oh, well, maybe we'll tweak it a little bit. I mean, the Sovereignty Act to me is a perfect example where Danielle Smith via Rob Anderson, issued this idea of this Alberta Sovereignty Act, and the picture that she painted while she was going her through her leadership race was this will give us all of the powers, and there was no shortage of constitutional scholars, legal experts, political scientists who said none of it works like that. You can't do that. And she decided she won the leadership. She introduced the bill, and it seemed like everybody, including apparently, one can only assume a good chunk of her cabinet went, no, it doesn't work like that. And then there were multiple iterations of the Sovereignty Act that got to this paper tiger that exists now. Is that like, here's the question that I want to ask. I'll do it this way. With the introduction of Bill 18, Danielle Smith openly said, no, this is how good policy is built. I identify something that I believe is a problem, and then I introduce legislation, and then we do all the back end work. It feels like that's not actually how it's supposed to work, but am I wrong?
Well, I look, the I feel like I'm stepping in front of my public policy class now. We're going to talk about the policy cycle. People can Google it, go ahead. Policy cycle, first thing you need to know is that it is an ideal. It doesn't hardly ever get followed, but there are stages in that, right? There's agenda setting where somebody identifies a problem, could be the premier, right? Then you go back and you ask people who are most affected by it, stakeholders and partners, and members of the public service and academics sometimes, right? Can you develop me some options? Right? What are some options for handling this problem? Right? And one, I think one of the myths, and one would hope that she has interactions with many of the talented deputy ministers that are in that government that are not putting her off from this, because I think that they do provide this kind of advice. But when I was briefing ministers, I would always say, look, here are the options. Here's what I'm recommending you do. But here are the implications of my chosen recommendation. Here are the implications of following these other paths. So at least if you choose those other options, you know what you're going to encounter, right? It's my job as a public servant not to get her reelected, right? Not to get that minister or that government reelected. That's not my job. My job is to make sure they're in a position to deliver on their commitments to Alberta, right? They're a democratically elected government, right? So that's the job, but that piece is being circumvented. And you raised Bill 18 is a perfect example of this, right? Bill 18, for folks that haven't been paying attention, is the "stay out of my backyard" bill, I think is what
That's how
Daniel
she likes to
called it.
refer
That's
to
her
it.
words. Yeah. I mean, this is essentially requiring all municipalities and public bodies, including universities, school boards, to get provincial government approval before they enter into any kind of agreement with the federal government, right? Any new agreement, any renewal, anything like that. Now, if she would have consulted anyone in intergovernmental relations who's currently responsible for vetting all of the typical federal provincial agreements, that was my job, by the way, for 5 years, was vetting like dozens. Our little unit of about maybe 12 to 14 people vetted anywhere from 400 to 800 agreements a year. We signed about 400 a year. But if she'd asked anybody that's involved in that process for all of the agreements that exist between departments, like the Department of Health, the Department of Education, and the federal government, that's always existed. It's existed for a very long time. They would tell you that that is a very involved process, right? And it tells me that they didn't ask people that are in those positions or have done that work, because Minister McIver said it takes about 10 minutes to vet an agreement like that. I don't know who told him that or whether he came up with it on the fly. 10 months is actually a pretty good target for a lot of these agreements, because, first of all, the federal government, when they're signing an agreement with any kind of provincial body, whether that be a department or an agency, they're not going to send it to the premier's office for vetting first. So for the first thing is you got to figure out what agreements are out there, right? You got to build relationships with these bodies and departments so that they trust you enough to bring you those agreements. And I can't tell you how many times we caught departments signing agreements that we didn't catch. There's going to be tons in this bill that are never actually going to make it through the formal process. But even then, it comes to an intergovernmental relations official like myself. We look through it for constitutional implications. Does it meet the overall intergovernmental objectives? Do we know that something happened in another agreement on another part of government that we could bring in a good clause that worked for them that didn't? That's a big part of the process. But then I have to work with Alberta Justice lawyers, because there's a legal lens you got to put on these things. There's a finance lens, there's a risk management lens. Internally, it takes months to vet an agreement, not 10 minutes. And then you have to engage with the federal government, right? Which is often just as difficult, right? And I joked with some of my officials, you want to know how difficult it is to do this work. Try to get somebody from federal Privy Council office to agree with an Alberta Justice lawyer on clause, right? It takes a ton of time and diplomacy and talent. So it's not as if they're going to be able just to pull anybody off the street to do this work. You got to train them. And it's going to take a lot of increased manpower in order to do this work. Now, if they had consulted anyone who works in this space, they would have told you 14,000 agreements, which is what they pegged Bill 18 to cover, that will require staffing up like dozens of new intergovernmental relations officials within the Executive Council or within the Premier's office, but also within all of those bodies, right? The school boards, the universities, right? The municipalities. Now, I hope they're going to go out and do this engagement over the summer and realize that it's going to be a logistical nightmare. It's why the government of Quebec didn't extend it beyond municipalities, right? Because they know just how much person power it would take to do this.
And one of the pieces that's fascinating to me that seems to, I mean, there's two that I want to hit on real quick here. The provincial government seems to be saying, I mean, the way that you did that policy process, you talked about the first thing you have to do is sort of set the policy. What's the problem that we're trying to solve here? What are our goals? And it's very, very clear with some of the policies, it seems very, very clear with some of the policies that, as you said, it's barbecue season. We got to throw the red meat out there. But there's so the province has its goals, it has its policies, but it seems to me there's a disconnect between, and so does the federal government, because if it's okay for the province to take this sort of incredibly strong unilateral, or threaten to take this incredibly strong unilateral action, then I can't think of any good reasons why the federal government wouldn't say, well, we're going to take our ball and go home then. Because if you're not going to play the game by the rules that have been established for quite some time, then we're not going to play with you. And you can explain that to your province. Am I getting that wrong?
No, you're not. And in the years that I spent intergovernmental relations, that our approach, from what I understand, was the same since the 1970s. It wasn't to leave money on the table from the federal government. It was simply to get more and cleaner money into Alberta. When I say cleaner money, it means with fewer strings attached. Now, I assumed when we were talking about the legislation before it was released and before the rhetoric started flowing, that that was what this was about. And that's one of the reasons why I came out in favor in principle of this bill, right? Before they actually started talking about what the purpose was. But that honestly doesn't seem to be but what they're in it for. I'll give you one concrete example, right? It was an announcement yesterday where the Justice Ministry is saying we're walking away from, a number of new federally appointed judges that we've been begging in Alberta for family courts. We're walking away from that money. We don't want it because there's too many strings attached. It requires us to remold family courts in a way that we don't agree with. So we're willing to walk away from it. And what was the federal response right away? And this will be the case until the Trudeau government is gone. They said, fine, we're going to redistribute those judges to other provinces that want them, right? And anybody who's been even close to that justice file for the last two couple of decades, if they were asked, would have said, we need the judges. We can work with the federal government to negotiate this. It's going to take a little bit of time. You got to be able to give a little bit. But you're right. The federal government said, if you don't want to play, we'll send the resources, be they judges or money, to other jurisdictions that want it. That's not anything new, though, right? I mean, you look at the history of Medicare in this country. The two provinces that stood in the way of developing universal health care across the country were Manitoba and Alberta, two staunchly conservative provinces. The only thing that changed their mind was when they started to see, when Albertans and Manitobans started seeing the rest of the country, wow, they've got some really cool shit over there, right? We want that. Why are we paying federal dollars for all these other provinces to have these great programs? And that in recent history here in Alberta is how it played out. But in that case, in healthcare, Alberta signed on to the healthcare deal, and we have the same kind of system that more or less that they do in the rest of the country. Same thing happened with childcare, right? The only reason why Ontario and Alberta signed on is because Albertans rose up and said, why are we paying for low-cost childcare in other jurisdictions? We want in too. So if Albertans want this stuff, they're going to have to stand up and say, yeah, we want it. Right.
One of the things, and throughout this conversation, but even as I was sort of ruminating heading into the conversation, knowing that it was going to be policy heavy and policy development heavy and all of that, I kept thinking, I don't know if you've ever seen the Errol Morris film, The Unknown Known. It's the biopic slash interview with Donald Rumsfeld. And
Oh, yeah.
it's a fascinating film for a lot of different reasons, but it's the end sequence that always has kind of stuck with me because Donald Rumsfeld gets so close to what I think is probably one of the biggest policy truths out there is you have to know what you know, you have to know what you don't know, and you have to know that there's things that you don't know. And he screws it up at the end, and Errol Morris comes in and is like, "Hey, so that doesn't make any sense." And he's like, "Oh yeah, I guess you're right. Maybe it's the other way around." But it seems like that willingness to be open to maybe there's things I'm missing here. What are the things that I don't know is gone from government? And so I guess one of the questions that I want to ask you is how do we get that back? How do we get politicians to be open to the idea before you roll out this sweeping policy? Maybe do some background work to see if there's things that you don't know.
Yeah, it's the case that I don't think they know what they don't know. They don't know their unknown unknowns, right? My biggest worry is that they don't want to know their unknowns, right? And I'm an optimist at heart, but if you take a look at the way that they're trying to, at least rhetorically, they're trying to wade into issues of academic freedom through Bill 18, right? It does suggest that they think they have the answers, right? It suggests that academic freedom, by the way, is just based on this bedrock democratic notion. It's not just an ivory tower concept. It's built into the bedrock of our democracy, that the pursuit of truth or the pursuit of truths should be left up to a group of people that can't agree with themselves, let alone each other, most of the time, instead of allowing the pursuit of truth to lie with a group of people who have power and think they know all the answers already. And the UCP's approach to wading into the peer review process for the assignment of research grants across the country suggests they think they have all the answers. And your question is like how do we reinject some level of humility? Let's start with that. Some level of humility, some level of appreciation for understanding those unknown unknowns. I think it has to start with average Albertans saying enough's enough, right? And saying, you know what? This policy that you're launching may not affect me directly, but it just seems like you're going about this in a slipshod nature, right? And it's sad to say, but I think it's going to take some policy disasters that are really going to affect the lives and livelihoods of a lot of Albertans for them to realize that. And the tragic nature of this is that they think they have all the answers on addiction, and our addiction numbers, our deaths through overdose continue to climb. And every week we see the results of their approach on trans rights policy, with young people committing suicide, some of them directly attributing it to the reaction that they received as a result of the bill. It's a sad thing to say, but that is really the only natural consequence for folks that don't understand their unknown.
How do you think? I mean, one of the things that I feel like, I can't say that I've observed because we're speaking somewhat empirically, and so I want to stay away from speaking empirically when I should. But one of the things that I feel like this government is also not aware of, and politicians in general, I'm not just going to just say, "Ah, oh, Danielle Smith is just the worst." I'm not going to say that. But it seems like there's a lot of politicians who are largely unaware that their rhetoric, the words that they use, how they choose to present their ideas or their policy things, those things can have very much a chilling effect. And I look at the range of statements that I've seen from academic institutions. I'm not going to name any names, but there are, municipalities, there's some municipality groups who have come out and said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. This is not okay. We're hoping that the government realizes that they need to not do this in the way that they're describing, because this is a catastrophe." And there certainly have been a few academic institutions that have said, "This is a friggin' train wreck." There's no shortage of academics who have come out and said, "This is like foundationally destructive to democracy." And then when you look at some of the statements that have come from other academic institutions, it's like, "We'll be watching this closely." And there's, it seems like there's almost that chilling effect of, "Hey, if you're going to say crazy stuff, I'm worried that you might do crazy stuff, and so I don't want to piss you off too much, but that does that do enough to stop the crazy stuff?" Like, how do we get politicians to realize, and people in positions of leadership to realize, your words can actually have very real consequences? And it could be things like academic institutions not speaking out when they have concerns, but it also absolutely can be continued deaths from a toxic supply. It absolutely can be continued deaths from marginalized groups that are only feeling their targeting increase. How do we get people to, like, what's, there are already dead trans kids. What's the body count? Like, what's the number that we need to get to before Danielle Smith and the UCP go, "Oh yeah, that's too many"? And why does it have to be that way?
Well, I wish I had an answer for you there.
It was
I
like a
mean,
really
if we're getting really quite morbid here, but that's the reality. I mean, if those two issues alone aren't enough to make we get back to the original part of our conversation here, to make Joe Albertan, right, connect with it, then it's hard to see what will. But I want to leave as a more of a positive note for folks that are advocating
I
in
got a
this space,
positive note I'm going to come to.
right? It's this that and Albertans aren't different from other Canadians in this way. They don't tend to pay attention to an issue and care about it until it affects somebody that they know, right? So I'm going to take you back to a focus group that we did up in Fort McMurray in the fall of 2019. I was surprised at this focus group, that it went this way. We have this exercise again where we ask people to draw us an Albertan, and they usually draw Joe. And then as a group, they have to pick one that they think is like the quintessential or most typical Albertan, and they always pick Joe. We only ever had two women, by the way, that have been chosen, and they both were married to Joe as oil and gas workers. So anyway. So we were doing this activity, and they up in Fort McMurray in 2019, and they picked Joe. And then we lead them through a series of activities where we ask them to park their own personal opinions at the door and just tell us about life through Joe's eyes. So what would Joe say? What would Joe do? What would Joe think? And we put up in one activity, put up a picture, a series of pictures of different people. And we asked them, how would Joe say these people got to be where they are? So one of them is like the CEO of General Motors. How would Joe say he got to be where he is? Typical answer, hard work, right? And it's drawing on that whole prosperity doctrine that seems to inspire Alberta conservatives. But one photo that we put up is of a person living rough, right? It's a person living rough on the street. In this case, up in Fort Mac, this person happened to be black. And we were assuming in that environment was a room full of blue collar white men with a few women, right? We were expecting them to say personal responsibility, right? This guy is living rough, his own fault, bad choices, could pull himself up by his bootstraps and so on. But what was fascinating to me was that notion didn't come up at all. They said, well, no, Joe would empathize with that person. You know, Joe would feel bad for him. Joe would go buy him a sandwich. Joe might even invite him over and see, you know, and get a shower, and he won't need anything. And I went, really? So as a social scientist, your job is to try to disconfirm what's happening in a room like that. So I go, really? He wouldn't say it's this guy's own fault? And they said, no. And I said, what's behind that? He's like, well, because Joe sees that kind of thing all the time. And I look back on this now, and we were really just on the upswing of the opioid crisis in Alberta, right? But it was still bad at the time, and it was affecting a lot of the guys in the camps. And Joe happened to work in a camp, and he knows that good people fall on hard times, right? So for activists that are working in that space and other policy spaces that feel like they're pushing 1,000 marbles up the hill, I always remind them that, you know, you got to make these issues pertinent to people. You got to tell stories that resonate with people, right? And this is why I think the folks that are working in the safe supply space, Petra Schultz and others, who are telling the stories of their kids, God bless them, man. That is a tough, you know, that is a tough thing to do. I have kids myself. You do. Can you imagine? You know, going out in front of cameras and doing this day in and day out. But those stories matter because they connect with people. And they make it very personal, right? So let's not let these kids die in vain because of this trans rights legislation. Let's tell their stories. If their families are willing to tell those stories, we should tell those stories because that's what resonates with people. That's what change minds. That's what changes minds, and that's what changes governments.
I mean, you kind of, I feel like you may have just answered my question, but I want to work my way towards like a little bit of a call to action specifically for people on the day to day, because, you know, I go back to the beginning, some of those social issues that you talked about the gaps on, whether it's supervised consumption sites or the pronoun use or the opioid crisis. And I think it's really important to highlight there is a big difference between addiction and deaths. And the addiction rates in the province are largely static. We're not seeing huge rates of addictions increases, but we are seeing huge rates of death increases. So at a certain point, I feel like maybe there's room for a conversation about maybe this isn't so much an addiction problem as it is a poison problem. Not saying, just saying. But how do we close the gap? Because we started this off by saying, you know, people think this is how I feel, but then they go, oh, but everybody else feels that way. And I don't want to be that guy with the podcast and the silly shirt. So how do we get people to, how do we close that gap to make people more comfortable to go, you know what? No.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The good news is that there's actually a lot of research on this already. So the concept we're talking about in political science and sociology is called the false sense of social reality Or it's called pluralistic ignorance. So folks can go ahead and Google those terms,
I like
right? I
that
mean, it sounds like it's made up of somebody who's sipping a bit too much brandy, but there we are, right? And all of the research will tell you, as soon as people become aware of their own pluralistic ignorance, as soon as people realize that they are so off base with where they think public opinion is, they change their attitudes and they change their behavior. So I'm not an, you know, this thing, I'm not an activist, right? I mean, I meet with anybody that will meet with me to talk about how, what public opinion is in Alberta. I'm not there to move it forward, but we are there to hold a mirror up to Albertans in a real way to say, here's who you are and here's who you think you are. What you do with that is up to you. But if folks really want to, you know, get a good sense of where public opinion is, they can go to our website and look up. You can just Google Viewpoint Alberta. There's actually a town called Viewpoint Alberta, so not that site, but Viewpoint Alberta is the project. You can look at our latest public opinion research and look to see where is mainstream public opinion. And for a lot of folks, you know, that tune into your show, they might actually be surprised in a pleasant way where public opinion is, that you don't actually need to change people's minds to be moderate or progressive. But at the same time, there's a lot of people who look at things like pronoun use, same group of people, and go, whoa, that's where public opinion is. Well, if we want to shift it, at least we can do it with full knowledge of where it is. So I think the more people go to trusted academic, peer-reviewed, you know, systems like ours that show you where public opinion actually is, I think the better off we're going to be. And once people realize that there's a gap between who we are and who we think we are, I think we can start to change things.
I only have two more questions. So just to be clear, are you making the argument that properly funded academic research can actually have a significant impact on not just moving a province forward, but the shape of democracy?
Yeah, it is. Full disclosure, I suppose it's necessary now. I mean, our research is funded by the Social Sciences Humanities Research Council of Canada.
Oh, that's that
And
biased one that Justin Trudeau controls.
But I will say this, and this is probably another talk. But I mean, we were unsuccessful three straight times in trying to get this study funded, right? So big thanks to the Killam Institute, private you know, private trust here, in the KIAS, the Kuhl Institute for Advanced Research at the University of Alberta, for allowing us to continue doing our focus groups and surveys while we got SHRC funding. But the notion that you know, studies like ours that are really challenging the status quo are automatically somehow funded by the government of Canada is just simply not true. We struck out three times. It was only our fourth time they got through, and it was because of the academic rigor. We improved the methodology as we went along. We gathered more evidence to show that our approach is actually effective, right? That's what is important in academic research, not that some minister sitting in a ledge in Edmonton thinks it's a good idea or a good study. That's not the way it works.
And I just want to be really clear. I was being entirely sarcastic about the one that Justin Trudeau controls. We actually are hoping to get Andrea DeCacciari on the show fairly soon here to have a conversation about how that is empirically false for so many reasons. But I also think that it's really important to highlight that you do want funding to have that high requirement for academic rigor. I should not be able to go to an academic research funding agency and say, I would really like to find out which kind of pie I like the most. And so I'm going to eat pie every day for the next year and you should pay for it. Okay. Obviously, that's garbage. And you have to have those academic rigor pieces in. So yeah, and I think it's yeah, it's so dumb. It's just so dumb. And also, like, I here's one other thing I just want to say to get off my chest, because I haven't had a chance to say yet. The complaint that if we had more conservative research grants, we would somehow graduate more people from journalism school who had more conservative viewpoints. A, I graduated from journalism school and I don't remember any research grant. Like, nobody was talking about what research grants should we apply for. It was a long time ago. But research and journalism are not necessarily, academic research into these things are not the same thing as journalism. But also, I think it's also important to realize that there's a lot of people who are involved in journalism who have no official training whatsoever. My last question for you, sir.
Well, can I jump in on that before you ask the last
Yeah,
question?
absolutely.
It's a very, very, very quick point. I think this is another case of the UCP and Daniel Smith needing to be careful what they wish for, because there aren't many actual conservative academics out there who look at their approach to public policy making as a good thing, right? I mean, before the last election, I co-authored an article with a leading conservative thinker in this country who challenged the notion that her government is even conservative in the first place. So, she should be careful if she wants more conservatives to look at the way her government functions, because in many ways it's eroding the very foundations and institutions of our democracy that conservatives value.
I just think it's smart not to piss off the smart people, because they're very smart and they will school you. My last question, I wasn't going to ask this one. This wasn't on my list when we first started, but as we went through the conversation, I need to know. I know that you travel the province and you do these events with Common Ground, where you talk to people, get their perspectives. This is all, a lot of this gets published on the Viewpoint website that you mentioned. Have you ever done an event in Viewpoint?
Oh, well, that's a good one. We should go out to Viewpoint, Alberta. We
I'm
look,
just
I mean,
saying.
smallest towns we've been to are St. Paul and Hannah. I think Viewpoint is substantially smaller than that. So we might get the entire population out. It's a great idea for our fifth anniversary. We're celebrating our fifth anniversary of Common Ground this fall. I think you just gave us an idea. Well, you should come. We should shoot the pod there.
If you guys do an event in Viewpoint and you let me know the when, I will be there.
Awesome.
Dr. Jared Wesley, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I always enjoy chatting with you. I know it's been a while since we've had you on the show. We've managed to cross paths a couple of times outside of the show, and I always really, really enjoy your perspective and your insight into things because you are so I don't know what the word unbiased, I guess, would be the word. Like, you care about the data, you care about the information. And I've never not once encountered a moment with you in any conversation where it's been like, oh, is this going to go against the ideological grain? You just say the things, which I think is fantastic. And we need more of that in these conversations so that people know what the unknowns are. And everybody should watch that flick. The soundtrack's amazing. Just saying.
You bet. And we both, and I think what we share in common is we both care deeply about democracy in this province. And conversations like this are important to it. So thanks for having.
Awesome. Thank you so much, sir.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. Whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of The Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.